Hey, hope you're enjoying the Grave Talks. Each and every week, we're now giving you two brand new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Today and every Wednesday, we're going to flash back to some of our favorite interviews of the past. To listen to our complete archive of episodes, along with commercial-free advanced episodes of the show, months before they're released to the public, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. It's only $5. You sign up now at patreon.com/thegravetalks or follow the links at thegravetalks.com. Today on The Grave Talks, the ghost of Rhoda Derry. Rhoda Derry was a victim of our society's once cruel and bizarre system of treatment of the mentally ill. Her life was also an example of how one can find peace and overcome such disturbing treatment when matched with the right care. Does the spirit of Rhoda Derry still haunt the last location she called home? Did the horrendous abuse suffered by Rhoda Derry leave a permanent imprint on the world that we live in today? Some still claim to see the ghost of Rhoda Derry on the grounds of the Peoria State Hospital. Is the ghost of Rhoda Derry finally at peace? We discuss the tragic story today with Sylvia Schultz.
In order to talk about Rhoda Derry, we really also do need to talk about the Peoria State Hospital and Dr. George Zeller. Now, when you say haunted mental asylum, your mind automatically goes all American Horror Story on you, mm-hmm. and you automatically assume that there was pain and fear and abuse. And it is my privilege and my great joy to tell people this was not the case at the Peoria State Hospital. This was a place where patients were treated like family. Dr. Zeller always used to tell people about this fine old word, asylum. This is a place where people can come to get help. And if somebody is beyond help, this was a place for them to live and be cared for as long as they needed to be. So Dr. Zeller felt very strongly about not having any sort of restraints at all. And this becomes important in Rhoda's story, too. Mm-hmm. Dr. Zeller believed that patients would come to the asylum from other poorhouses and from other hospitals, and they would come in straitjackets. And Dr. Zeller would have his staff confiscate any straitjackets, handcuffs, foot cuffs that the patients arrived in. And Dr. Zeller would keep all of these items, and he kept them in a room next to his office. And the only reason he kept any of them was for his staff to point to and say, never again, not here, not at this asylum. He felt very strongly about that. When Dr. Zeller became superintendent of the Peoria State Hospital in 1902, before he took the job, he was actually a surgeon in the Army. He was serving in the Philippines in the Spanish-American War. So the asylum was built without him there. And it was furnished with all of the things that an asylum of that time, the very early 20th century, would have had, which meant that there were bars on the windows, which meant that they had a couple of Utica cribs, which meant that they had straitjackets and foot cuffs and handcuffs and all those horrible things. Dr. George Zeller came onto the scene in 1902, and he got rid of all of these things, with one exception, which I'll tell you about. First of all, he took all of the bars off of the windows. He insisted that the staff in the cottages leave the windows open about an inch and a half so that the patients could see that they weren't locked in. He said, these people don't lock their doors at home. Why on earth would we lock them in here when they've come to us for help? Mm-hmm. So this is a state hospital.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Dr. Zeller had to make an accounting of everything he did to the board and to the state. And that was the first thing the board said was, okay, you've just taken $6,000 worth of bars off of the windows. What are you planning on doing with that? Well, what Dr. Zeller did was he made a zoo on the grounds. And those bars from the windows were repurposed into cages for the animals. There were deer, there were squirrels. The squirrels that you see in Bartonville now are the descendants of the squirrels that were in the petting zoo that this asylum had. There was a black bear that was so tame that the patients would take it around to the cottages, and this black bear would take a bath in pools on command. And it was the patients caring for these animals, for the petting zoo, basically, on the grounds. I mentioned Utica cribs. This will be very important in Rhoda's story as well. The asylum did have a couple of Utica cribs when we first started out, and Dr. Zeller turned those Utica cribs into mangers. He filled them with hay for the deer to eat out of. The only reason we have any Utica cribs surviving from those very early days is that Dr. Zeller kept one, and he would fill it with the straitjackets that he had confiscated and the handcuffs and the leather mitts that they would put on people. And he would take this Utica crib around to state fairs, and he would display it, and he would tell people, this is what your loved one will not be subjected to if they need to come to us for help, for treatment. So he used that as an object lesson, which was really kind of neat. So we do actually have, in the Peoria State Hospital Museum, we have the only remaining Utica crib from the Peoria State Hospital's very early days, and that's the only reason it survived, is because it wasn't used as a rabbit hutch or a deer manger.
Sure, and it's really quite amazing that in this story that we're about to hear of the Peoria State Hospital, in so many other cases when a state hospital is brought up, it's typically not a good place. It's typically not a great final place for many people. But in this case, in the case of Rhoda Derry, it was a saving grace. It was a place that really rescued her out of another location, the Adams County Poor Farm, which is where really her the dark side of her story begins.
It begins before.
Yeah, it truly. I was just correcting myself there. It really truly begins slightly before that with the relationship that she was in. Why don't we take a step back to that, into that relationship, and walk us into how did Rhoda end up at the Adams County Poor Farm? What happened there?
Oh, it was a long, tortuous journey for her, the poor dear. So now that we've looked at the Peoria State Hospital, we can talk about Rhoda's story. Rhoda was born in 1834. She was actually born in Indiana, and her family moved to Adams County in Illinois, which is downstate. It's down by Quincy. So she was the youngest of nine children. Beautiful, beautiful young girl. Dark hair, flashing eyes. She was really, really a pretty girl. She was maybe a little bit spoiled. We don't know. Being the youngest of nine children, she certainly knew what she wanted. And when she was 16 years old, she did the most natural thing in the world. She fell in love. Rhoda's family lived in Adams County, and there was a neighboring farm family called the Phoenixes. And Charles Phoenix was also 16 years old. And Rhoda caught his eye, and they started courting. We don't know exactly how far their relationship went, but we do know that after they had been courting for a couple of years, Charles asked Rhoda to marry him, and she said yes. Most natural thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was one person who really was not very happy about this relationship between Rhoda and Charles. That was Nancy Phoenix, Charles's mother. Now, as I said, Rhoda was the youngest of nine children. The Derrys were dirt poor. They were very, very poor. They were not very well off at all. In all the census records that mention the Derry family, they are shown as being tenant farmers on other farmers' land. They didn't even have land to call their own. The Phoenixes, on the other hand, were rather well off. And Charles was the oldest son of only four children. So he stood to inherit his father's land after Frederick passed away. So Nancy Phoenix was not about to have her baby boy Charles marry one of these dirt poor Derrys. She was not having that. She was so insistent on this, on destroying this relationship, that she confronted Rhoda in the street one day. And she said, "If you do not release my son from this engagement, I will curse you." Now, talking about witchcraft in front of Rhoda Derry was a really good way to get her attention very quickly, because this part of Rhoda's story starts even before she's born. Rhoda's grandmother, Moll Derry, was known as the fortune teller of the Revolution. Moll and her husband Valentine grew up in Germany, and around the time of the Revolutionary War in the colonies, Valentine was conscripted by the British to fight in the Revolutionary War on the British side. Well, Moll was not about to be left behind, so she disguised herself as a man and emigrated with Valentine, and once she got here, she fought at Valentine's side, still dressed as a man. They switched sides, fought for the revolution. When the Revolutionary War was over, Moll and Valentine settled in Pennsylvania, and Moll became a very powerful practitioner of Pennsylvania Dutch hex magic. She was known for counties around as being able to lift and cast curses. So, talking about witchcraft in front of Moll Derry's granddaughter, Rhoda, really was a good way to get her attention. Unfortunately, Rhoda took Nancy's threat seriously. A couple weeks after this confrontation with Nancy Phoenix, Rhoda started acting very, very strangely. She had some sort of break with consensual reality. She came home and swore that the devil was after her. She said she was being attacked by Old Scratch, an old-fashioned name for the devil. She would do things like, the family lore says that she would spin around on her head on the bed, like a top. I don't know if that refers to some sort of fit, if that's the best way to describe it. But she started having very serious problems. She went downhill very quickly. Her parents decided to have her committed to the state hospital in Jacksonville, Illinois. Now, the real tragedy about, one of many tragedies about Rhoda's life, is that the state hospital in Jacksonville had been set up just a couple years before Rhoda was committed there. It was not designed for long-term care. Patients were allowed to stay for 2 years. If they didn't get better in 2 years, you had to give your place in the hospital up to somebody who might actually be able to be helped. The treatment at the state hospital was very simple. It was a lot of talk therapy. And whatever was wrong with Rhoda probably would have been able to be helped quite a lot with talk therapy. But talk therapy only works if you start it right away, within the first 6 months. And it was a couple of years before Rhoda's parents decided to put her in the state hospital. So that chance was gone. That chance to help her was gone. When she was in Jacksonville, Rhoda experienced something very strange. She was a very violent patient. She was kept in the locked ward. She was locked in her room every night. And every morning, the attendants on that ward would find Rhoda gone. She was out of her room. They would find her wandering the grounds of the hospital looking for Charles. And the attendants would find her, and they'd take her back to her room, and they'd say, "Who let you out? You were locked in your room all night. Who let you out?" And Rhoda's answer was always the same. "Nancy Phoenix let me out." Now, I have my own my own theory as to what happened there. That's something we've never been able to explain. I have my own theory about it.
Okay.
I think that Rhoda probably was missing Charles so much, and she was so traumatized by his loss, that she created a thought form for herself. She created a tulpa. She created a thought form in the shape of Nancy Phoenix, this person who threatened her with witchcraft. And that thought form grew strong enough that it was able to open the door, and Rhoda was able to escape that cell every night.
Okay.
The tragedy about this part of Rhoda's life is that these are small towns that Charles and Rhoda were living in. Word gets around. Word was getting around that Rhoda was having serious problems. Nancy actually went to the dairy cabin and wanted to see Rhoda and wanted to tell her, "You're fine. There is no curse. Snap out of it. You know, you're not cursed. You're okay." And Rhoda refused to see her. The Derry family would not let Nancy into the house for anything, and I don't blame them a bit. So, yeah, Nancy and her family and Charles, too, they just sort of disappear from the historical record. We can't find them.
How bizarre.
After about 1848 or so, they're just not in the historical record anymore. I don't know what happened to them. So, Rhoda went downhill. She was released after 2 years in Jacksonville as being incurable. Her family cared for her at home as long as they could, but in 1860, Rhoda's mother died. And Rhoda's mother was about the only person who really tried to understand what Rhoda was going through. Rachel was very protective of Rhoda. One of the ways that Rhoda's mania manifested was that she thought that invisible witches were attacking her, and she would cower under the table in this cabin and scream that invisible witches were swooping down to attack her. Rachel took to keeping a pistol in her apron pocket. And whenever Rhoda would suffer these fits and start screaming about the invisible witches, Rachel would whip out this pistol and start firing it around the cabin. Not exactly sure how good that was for Rhoda's mental health, but Rachel was doing the best she could with the information that she had. So in 1860, Rachel passed away. And Rhoda was left with her father, Jacob. Jacob could no longer care for her. Rhoda was just too violent. She was a danger to herself and to others. So Jacob made the heartbreaking decision at that point to have Rhoda committed to the Adams County Almshouse. Now, almshouses in the middle of the 19th century had the potential to be awful, awful places. If you had $25 for a license and an empty barn in your backyard, you could open up your very own almshouse. Because at that point in time, they didn't think that the mentally ill could feel heat or cold or hunger. In some cases, in the worst cases, the mentally ill were treated no better than animals. They were kept outside in drafty barns. The Adams County Almshouse was not that bad. It was a county house. It was a county poorhouse. So it did have board oversight. They had a board that they had to answer to. It was a lovely little brick building on really nicely rolling hills. It had a good water source. But the unfortunate fact is that an almshouse or a poorhouse or a poor farm, whatever you want to call it, is simply a place where if you're down on your luck, you can go and get three hots and a cot. They were not prepared to deal with the mentally ill, but poor people go crazy too. And the Adams County Almshouse was absolutely unprepared to attend to the needs of someone with Rhoda's depth of crazy. She developed a condition called pica, which is a compulsion to eat inappropriate objects. She would lunge at people as they walked past, and she would try to pick the buttons off of women's blouses and swallow them. She would crawl around on the floor, and anything she found on the floor, a pin, a penny, a nail, would go straight into her mouth, and she would try to swallow it. If they gave her a piece of fried chicken for her dinner, she would cram it into her mouth, bones and all. So for her own protection, the superintendent of the Adams County Almshouse decided that Rhoda should be put into a Utica crib. Now, this is exactly what it sounds like. It looks just like a baby's crib. It's very close to the floor. It doesn't have the tall legs that a baby's crib would. It's pretty close to the floor. And it also has a barred lid, which locks. Now, Utica cribs were not designed as instruments of torture. In the 1880s, in the asylum in Utica, New York, where these cribs were developed, there was a reporter that went around, and he was doing this big expose on how horrible Utica cribs were. And it is true that some patients were put into the Utica crib because they were having a fit or something, and it turns out they were suffering from an epileptic fit and died in the crib. So they did this big expose. But the reporter talked to a few patients, and he talked to one patient, and the patient said, you know, I sleepwalk. That's part of what is wrong with me, is that I sleepwalk. And if a nurse puts me into a Utica crib and locks the lid, I know where I'm going to end up the next morning. I know where I'm going to wake up. And that is a big comfort to me. So these cribs were not designed as instruments of torture. However, they were also not designed for use longer than overnight. Utica cribs were usually lined with a thin hospital mattress. Rhoda's crib, however, was lined with straw. And there was a strategically cut hole in the bottom of the crib at about hip level, and a tray underneath the crib, just like a rabbit cage, and for the exact same reason. Rhoda was left in this crib for weeks and months at a time. When she was let out, her hips had atrophied so much that she couldn't stand unassisted. She crawled around along the floor. When she was let out, she was cared for by other feeble-minded patients. Sometime during the first 10 years of this treatment, Rhoda decided that she no longer wanted to watch the world go by through the bars of the cage, and she clawed her own eyes out. She beat on her teeth so much that her front teeth fell out. She spent decades in this situation. Now, in 1902, Dr. George Zeller became the superintendent of the Peoria State Hospital. And one of his guiding tenets was the fact that no one is beyond help. When the Peoria State Hospital began, it was called the Illinois Asylum for the Incurable Insane. And Dr. Zeller went to Springfield, our state capital, and he went to the legislature, and he said, you need to change the name of this asylum. He said, do not tell my patients they're incurable. That's what I'm here to do. So he got it changed eventually to Peoria State Hospital. So how do you prove that? How do you prove that no one is beyond help? Well, what you do, if you're Dr. George Zeller, is you go around to the poorhouses and the almshouses of the state, and you cherry pick the worst, most abused, most maltreated cases. That's exactly what Dr. Zeller did. He went around to the almshouses of the state, and he went in search of the most wretched abused cases. In 1904, he went to the Adams County Almshouse, and that's where he found Rhoda Derry. She had calmed down by that point enough to be moved to a box bed. She was wearing no clothes. She would not tolerate clothes against her skin. She was simply covered with a canvas sheet. And that's how Dr. Zeller found her. He took one look at Rhoda Derry and he said, "This patient is coming with me." And the superintendent of the almshouse didn't want to let Rhoda go, because he figured that the almshouse was going to be blamed for her condition. Yeah, go figure. And Dr. Zeller said, "Either this patient comes with me, or I shut your institution down effective immediately."
Mm-hmm.
So, September 26th, 1904. It had rained all day. There was bad storms during the day. So there was a washout on the railroad tracks between Quincy and Bartonville. The train got in very late that night. It wasn't until about 1:30 in the morning that the attendants and the nurses at Peoria State Hospital got the call that the train had finally arrived. There were about 60 patients being transported from Adams County to the Peoria State Hospital. They're being transported on boxcars. So the train pulled into the station right across from the storehouse and the general store. And the nurses and the attendants opened the doors and they escorted the patients out, and the patients were standing on the train platform, not sure what was going on. And the attendants got onto the boxcar just to make sure no one had been left behind. And at one end of the boxcar, they saw this great big wicker laundry basket. Now, this is unusual because usually the patients just arrive with the clothes on their backs. But they saw this big laundry basket and they were like, "Oh, well, okay, I guess this is patients' clothing. I guess since there are so many of them, they sent clothing along. We'll take the basket off too." So one attendant on either side of this great big laundry basket, and they hump it off of the boxcar and they set it down on the station platform. And all of a sudden, the lid to the laundry basket lifts up, the clothes part, and there sat Rhoda, jabbering at people toothlessly. She was being transported in the laundry basket because her hips had atrophied so much she could not sit in a wheelchair for any length of time. That night, for the first time in 44 years, Rhoda Derry slept in a bed with clean white sheets. The nurses at the asylum quickly decided that Rhoda would become the daughter of the asylum. They waited on her hand and foot. The moment her bedding became soiled, they whisked it away. They cared for her. She could no longer see, of course, but they made sure that she would experience the hilltop in any way that was left to her. They set her out in the gardens so she could feel the sun on her face and smell the flowers whose colors she could no longer see and listen to the bird songs. They took her to dances. They had dances every Saturday night at the asylum. And they brought Rhoda to those dances so that she could hear the music. Rhoda was still crawling around on the floor, of course, because she could not stand. It said that she never smiled when she was brought to the asylum, except when Dr. Zeller came into the room. I don't know whether it was the sound of his voice or the smell of his cologne, but Rhoda knew without a doubt that Dr. Zeller was her savior, and she adored him for it. Whenever Dr. Zeller came into the room, she lit up. Now, part of Rhoda's lore is that she picked up the habit of chewing tobacco when she was a teenager. And if she knew that you had tobacco in your pocket, she would crab across the floor and tug on your pants leg and beg for some chaw. Family lore has it that she would tell your fortune in exchange for a chaw of tobacco.
Okay.
So she kept up that habit when she was in the asylum. And everybody knew it, and everybody was tolerant of this. Dr. Zeller kind of made Rhoda into his poster child in a good way. He would invite reporters from all over the United States, all over the world, and they came to see the woman who was brought here in a basket. And Dr. Zeller would show them Rhoda, and he would say, "This is why we need state hospitals instead of letting these people suffer in poor farms, the mentally ill suffer in poor farms. Poor farms are fine for the poor, but not for the mentally ill." And he held Rhoda up as an example of the care that people could receive in state hospitals. Rhoda probably developed tuberculosis when she was in the poor farm, but in the summer of 1906, her case became full-blown. And she was moved from the cottage that she was living in into Dining Hall A. That sounds weird when I say it like that, but tuberculosis was a scourge at the Peoria State Hospital right from the jump, right from the very opening day, practically. There were four hospitals on the hilltop, but those quickly became overrun with tuberculosis cases. And Dr. Zeller realized that TB patients had to be segregated from everyone else. So Dining Hall A was pressed into service as a TB ward.
Sure.
So Rhoda was brought to Dining Hall A in the summer of 1906, and that is where she passed away October 9th, 1906, the day before she would have turned 72 years old.
It's amazing that she was able to get, I mean, obviously her quality of life was so bad because of everything that she went through at the Adams County poor farm. But it is, you know, what little bit of saving grace, you know, we can find in this, that part of her story is the fact that she was able to go to a place and live it out the best that she could in the state that she was in, and that others could hopefully, as Dr. Zeller was trying to do, learn from the mistakes that medicine and that people had been doing around individuals like her for so many years prior. Now, obviously, she passes away, and then we go many years into the future here, and this is where the stories of Rhoda still being around on the other side.
She is definitely still around.
Begin.
Yes. I mentioned her chewing tobacco habit.
Yeah.
That is part of her ghost lore. She loved that entire hilltop so much that she can be sensed anywhere on the hilltop, but especially in front of her grave. She is buried on the hilltop. She's buried in Cemetery 1. And if you are standing at her grave on the hilltop and you feel a tugging on your pants leg and you smell chewing tobacco, that's Rhoda that's trying to get your attention.
What was the first reported encounter of Rhoda?
The first reported encounter with Rhoda's spirit was several months after she died.
Really? Tell me that story.
I am not even kidding. Yeah, there were nurses that reported seeing Rhoda's cramped figure on the porch of the cottage that she used to live in. She was still hanging around, yeah.
So people almost immediately started noticing that this woman was still
almost immediately,
there.
Yeah.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Sylvia Schultz about the ghost of Rhoda Derry. In part two of our interview, we'll go in-depth into the haunting of Rhoda Derry. And what was the first reported encounter of her being a spirit after her passing? You might be surprised by this. And when the Peoria State Hospital was in operation as a hospital, did the ghost of Rhoda haunt the doctors and patients? We'll talk about those encounters. What did Rhoda say from the grave to an investigator about chewing tobacco? Is Rhoda still suffering in the same way she did in life while she is on the other side? We'll identify that. And is there a way to communicate easily with Rhoda today? Those questions and more in part two of our interview with Sylvia Schultz. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. For $5 a month, you'll have access to all of our part two interviews. Every single one of them you get access to. Just go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. You'll also get access to advanced episodes of our programs months before they are released to the public. So if you're already binged out and you need more episodes, patreon.com/thegravetalks to get access to all of our content. It's only $5 a month. That's what keeps our program on the air. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.